to work the edges of the room or the men near the bar. So he'd forgotten how it felt to take a girl by the waist, to hold her smaller hand in his and pull her close as he spun her around the room. He'd forgotten the way his head could spin as the music wrapped the couples in its hypnotizing rhythm, the way the entire world could narrow to one pair of golden eyes. He felt drunk suddenly, even though he hadn't touched the champagne either, off balance, inexplicably swept away by the song, by the moment, and against all his better judgment, by her. One glance at her face showed that she didn't feel the same. She moved gracefully, allowing him to lead her across the floor, but she wasn't really with him. Her concentration was on the room around them, not on the small, private world they were creating within the span of their arms and the rhythm of their steps. The realization was like water on a fire, and by the time the song wound down to its close, Hart had sobered. Convenient, because as Esta made her final curtsy to him, he caught sight of Jack Grew over the top of her head. He offered his arm to escort her off the floor, and when she accepted it, he bent his head toward hers.
"Are you ready?"
She gave a small nod as she met his eyes. He wasn't sure what he saw there now. Determination? Resignation? It worried him that he couldn't read her, didn't know what she was thinking. Not without using his affinity, and doing that would mean losing the one ally, however tenuous that might be, that he had. But the time for delaying was over. They had work to do. To sink the hook. The orchestra at the Haymarket had just finished a cloyingly sentimental waltz that had grated against Jack's already raw nerves. He was at the end of his rope. He'd put everything he had left, and a lot that wasn't his to take, into rebuilding his machine. The new machinist had been working day and night to restore the hunk of metal and wire, and it was nearly ready to try again. But trying it again was pointless unless he could figure out how to stop the blasted thing from exploding. He was running out of time. His father's ship would leave from London in another week. When he arrived in New York, his men of business would tell him about the emptied accounts, and Jack would be on a one-way train to Cleveland or some other godforsaken uncivilized place in the wilds of the Midwest. He wouldn't be around for the conclave, much less to make his triumphant return to the Order's good graces. But at least the Haymarket stocked passable scotch. He raised the glass to his lips, anxious for the numbing burn and the taste of smoke and fire, but when he tilted it back, he found it empty. He peered down, wondering when he'd finished the drink. Then he lifted the empty glass to signal the barmaid to bring him another while he waited for Darrigan and his doxy to show up. The thought of them arriving buoyed him a bit. The demonstration they'd done the night before had been remarkable. Impossible. He could use a little of the impossible on his side right now. Over the racket of the crowd, he heard his name and lifted his head to find Hart Darrigan walking toward him. On his arm was the girl from the night before. Tall and lean. She could have been an Amazon in another life, but in this one she was a vision in a gown spun from gold. If the dress wasn't enough to convince him that she was different from the usual theater types, the jewels at her neck would have been. No chorus girl had jewels like that. "Thanks for the invitation tonight," Darrigan said as he closed the distance between them, offering Jack his hand as he approached with the girl.
"I'm glad you could make it," Jack said, taking Darrigan's hand.
"Damn, if it isn't good to see him again," he thought suddenly. "Everything is going to be fine." Darrigan made a small flourish with his hand as he brought the girl forward.
"May I present Miss Esta von Filosik?"
Hart smiled warmly at the girl.
"Esta, this is a good friend of mine, a very important man in our city, Mr. Jack Grew."
Jack couldn't help but preen a bit under the praise.
"Miss Filosik,"
he said with a slight nod of his head. This close, he saw that his original impression had been right.
Her face was free from any paint, and her clothes were so well-fitted that they must have been custom-made.
"You must call me Esther," she told him, offering her hand.
She spoke with a foreign lilt to her voice, but it wasn't the guttural sound that filled the saloons of Lower Manhattan. Instead, it had the refinement of someone well-bred and educated.
"Any friend of Hart's is one of mine."
"Esther it is, then."
He took her hand and bowed low over it, lifting his eyes to take in the shapely bodice of her gown, the creamy expanse of her chest. She gave him a slow smile, peering up at him through her lashes, but then her eyes went wide. Her mouth opened in a soft O. "Well, well," he thought with anticipation, as the girl stared at him as though she appreciated what she saw.
"We arrived a bit early, and we're taking a turn around the floor. There's a table waiting upstairs," Hart told him. "If that's all right with you."
Jack released the girl's hand.
"That sounds fine."
"Wonderful."
The girl gave him a slow, encouraging smile.
"I believe the champagne should still be cold."
"Champagne, you say?"
He looked down at his empty glass, feeling that much better about the days ahead.
"That sounds as perfect as you look, my dear."
Deja vu. Esther cringed inwardly at Jack's obvious come-on. 100 years and men never figured out that lines like that didn't work. As Hart led her back to their table, it took effort to keep her features relaxed. She was still unsettled from the premonition she'd had when Jack had looked up as he bowed over her gloved hand. She'd been overwhelmed by the memory of those same eyes in a darkened hallway when he was pointing a gun at her before he turned it on Logan. If Hart hadn't started talking again, she would probably still be frozen, but she reminded herself that there was no way Jack could know her or remember her. She'd first met him in 1926. Some 24 years from now, she would be fine. She'd get through this. 10 minutes later, though, she regretted having him at their table. Hart was a different person around him, condescending and dismissive of everyone, including her. It was a part of their plan, she told herself. He was only giving Jack an opening, using her, the mistreated mistress, as bait. But it was still an ordeal to sit through. He was even worse than Logan, Esther thought as she listened to the two men bluster at each other. Logan had a sort of natural charm he used to disarm his victims, but Hart's was something more. Whatever charm he came by naturally had been cultivated and honed with the precision of an artist. It was so overwhelming that his mark had no choice but to be taken in by it. She did know better, and she'd almost been taken in by it, she admitted, thinking of the warm fluttering in her belly as they danced. The moment he'd taken her in his arms, she'd felt trapped and protected all at once, and she hated herself for almost liking the feeling. Hated that she'd had to focus on something, anything else, during the dance, because he was looking at her with an intensity that made her cheeks warm. The whole ordeal had made her feel things she didn't want to examine too closely. Unnerved, unbalanced, and maybe most dangerous of all, unsure. All part of his game, she reminded herself. A game she had to win. As she kept half of her attention on the conversation at their table and the other half on the ballroom, she couldn't help but think that Dakari's knife might still be somewhere in that building. It grated at her, the knowledge that she was a thief who couldn't even steal back something that belonged to her, and it worried her, going back to her own time without that bit of proof about what once had been. After the way the clipping had changed, who knew what future she'd be going back to? Jack was nearly through the first bottle of champagne when a flash of coppery hair caught her eye. Down on the floor, Bridget Malone was making her way along the edge of the room. Esther was on her feet before she realized what she was doing.
"Sweetheart?"
Hart asked, a warning threaded through the endearment. She didn't care about his warnings, though. He had Jack well enough in hand. She had to try. Would you gentlemen excuse me?
Where are you going?
Hart asked through his clenched teeth. She could still make out Bridget's fiery hair moving through the crowd.
Just to powder my nose, darling, she said with a shy smile. It will only take a moment. If one of you could direct me?
Back behind the bar,
Gru told her as he reached for the bottle again. His face had turned blotchy and red from the warmth of the room and the amount of wine he'd consumed. She could tell Hart wanted to protest, but she promised to return quickly before he could, and then made her way through the crowd. At first, she went in the direction Gru had pointed, but when she was out of view, she cut beneath the overhang of the balcony and headed in the direction Bridget Malone had taken. When she reached the corner of the room, she found that Bridget had vanished. There wasn't a door or hallway for the madam to have gone through, but the woman was gone. Confusion settled over Esta as she searched for some answer to Bridget's disappearance. She found it a moment later when a portion of the wall slid open and one of the waiter girls emerged carrying a tray of clean barware. Before the panel slid shut, Esta picked up her pace and slipped through the opening into the dark silence of an empty hallway. At the end of the passageway, Esta could just make out the glow of the flame Bridget held in her hand. From the smell of roasting meat that filled the air, the passage was also connected to the kitchens, but Esta wondered where else it might lead, and whether it was connected to the lower floors. The room Bridget had kept her in before was below, in the cellar of the building. The light wavered, and then the woman turned a corner and the passageway fell into shadow. Beams of light filtered through small holes in the wall, and Esta went to one and peered through to find a private dining room. From the looks of it, the passage was lined with more openings, probably so the management could keep tabs on their patrons without their knowledge. She peered through the next set of openings and found another room, this one filled with men smoking cigars and talking in voices amplified by alcohol and a sense of their own invincibility. Among them was the man who had assaulted her weeks ago, Charlie Murphy. His nose was still crooked, but the bruises on his face had healed. Not that it improved his looks any. She watched them, trying to follow the flow of their conversation. They were discussing some event, a gala to celebrate the spring equinox, from what she could understand. That was when it hit her. They were all members of the order.
It didn't last long enough,
a bald man was arguing as he pounded on the surface of the table, causing the stemware to shake.
Nearly a year,
another said.
In the past, it was more like a decade. The stones are dying.
The stones?
They aren't dying,
the bald man insisted.
But I agree, there's something fundamentally wrong. I can't believe it's the artifacts themselves, though. Maybe there was a problem with the ritual?
I'd like to see you tell the inner circle that,
Murphy laughed.
More likely, it's a problem with the maggots we've been able to find. My father used to say the Irish were bad, but these newest arrivals? Dirty and uneducated. And don't even get me started about the Jews and Catholics.
You're probably right. What power could possibly be derived from rabble like that? I'll tell you what needs to happen.
A waiter entered carrying trays of food, and the men seemed to take it as a signal to change the topic. Dolph had talked about people going missing. She wondered if this was connected to it in some way. The end of the hallway beckoned as the server made a show of carving the roast. In his presence, the men turned their conversation to mundane topics, sports and stocks and the damnable traffic that was growing every day. Anything but magic. Esta was growing impatient. Too much time had passed already. If she was going to get Dakari's knife, she had to go now. If only she could use her affinity. If she could slow time, she could be done in a blink, but she couldn't chance that. She had to make a choice. Did she go for the knife, or stay and see what more she could discover? Dakari or Dolph's crew? Her own past, or her new present? There wasn't time for both. She had one job. To get the book and to get home. Nothing was more important than that, not even Dakari. But the men on the other side of the wall were talking like there was a problem, like the order had a weakness. which was a fact that could only help them. Dolph and Professor Lachlan, all the mages. Dakari would understand. She peered through the openings and listened again, but before she could catch the thread of their conversation, she heard a familiar voice.
What are you doing here?
Bridget Malone was suddenly there, next to her in the darkness, and looking none too happy to see her. A trap in a trap. Hart glanced over the dance floor below, looking for some sign of Esther's return. She'd been gone too long. Had she run into trouble? Or was she up to something?
So tell me, Darrigan, how did you really meet the lovely Miss Folosic?
Jack tipped what was left of the bottle into his glass. The champagne fizzed and foamed over the edge of the bowl, dampening the white cloth on the table.
Are you and she...
He waggled his eyebrows suggestively.
We've been friends since we were children,
Hart said, leaving his answer open enough for Jack to make his own assumptions.
Really?
Jack smirked.
Yes. Believe it or not, the story I told on stage was true. I know Esta from my travels abroad. Her father was one of my first teachers. Perhaps you've heard of him, Baron von Filosic?
Jack's face bunched and Hart could practically see his alcohol-soaked mind trying to place where he'd heard that name. It took a moment, but then Jack's bleary eyes widened a fraction.
Not the Baron Franz von Filosic.
The same,
Hart said easily, relieved that Jack had finally made the first step toward entering his little game.
You knew the Baron?
Jack asked. He pretended he didn't notice Jack's surprise.
I was lucky enough to have lived with the Baron when I was just beginning my quest for knowledge about the mysteries of the elemental states. He saw some talent in me, and admired my drive to understand the secrets of the occult arts. It was he who directed me to the Far East and provided me with the introductions I needed to finish my studies. This was all before his untimely death, of course.
Jack frowned, puzzled.
I didn't know he had any family. Few did. Franz never married Esta's mother. It's maybe the only thing that saved her when his estate burned to the ground. I'm sure you've heard about that, the great tragedy it was. All of his breakthroughs were lost, his vast knowledge gone.
It probably set us back 50 years, maybe more,
Jack agreed. Hart leaned forward, his voice low.
Except, I don't think everything was destroyed.
Jack's brows went up, and even though his eyes were barely focusing, Hart saw interest in them. He could practically feel Jack's willingness to be convinced, to believe. It wouldn't take much more to push him the rest of the way.
Esta has a trunk she keeps under lock and key. Won't tell me what's in it, won't let me see what it contains.
Hart glanced to the left and right, making sure it looked like he was worried about being overheard. He lowered his voice.
I think it might be some of her father's papers.
You don't say.
Hart nodded.
You know what he was working on when he died, don't you?
Jack looked momentarily thrown off.
Oh, yes. Wasn't it the...
He hesitated.
The...
He snapped his fingers as though the words were on the tip of his tongue.
The transmutation of basic elements? Hart supplied helpfully.
Of course,
Jack agreed. Then he blinked through his alcoholic haze like someone just surfacing from sleep.
You're not saying he created the Philosopher's Stone.
Rumor had it that the good Baron was very close to a breakthrough.
Hart leaned forward.
In his last letters to me, he hinted that he'd been successful at isolating quintessence.
Ether?
Jack whispered, excitement clear despite the glassiness of his eyes. Hart nodded. But he died before he could answer any of my questions or tell me anything more.
Right,
Jack agreed.
terrible tragedy.
It was. Hart hesitated, like he wasn't sure if he should share a secret. More so if, as Esta believes, his death wasn't the accident it appeared to be. Jack blinked.
She believes it was foul play?
Hart leaned closer. She believes someone found out what the Baron was doing, how close he was to unlocking the secrets of divine power. Imagine what might be possible with that information. You could make the elements bend to your will.
Yes.
Jack licked his lips.
Imagine that. But who would want to stop him from such a great discovery?
When I studied with him, the Baron had suspicions he was being watched. He confided in me once that he worried there were those in the local village, Magus, who didn't want him to succeed. He'd made arrangements so his work wouldn't be lost in case anything happened. If that trunk of hers contains what I think it might, it would be a discovery of amazing importance, Jack.
You think she could be convinced to share it with us?
Jack asked, his expression unabashedly hungry. That's my problem, Hart frowned. We're old friends.
More than friends, really,
he said, imbuing his voice with a lecherous note. But she hasn't let me see what's inside. I think she's still testing me to see if I can help her. She's tired of living on the edges of society. She's the daughter of a baron, and while her father was alive, she lived like one. But with his death, she lost her income and any standing in her town. So she's come to this country, like so many come, to start again. She wants her old life back, to live like the daughter of a baron is entitled to live, and whatever's in that trunk, she believes it's enough to gain her entrance to the highest society. Again, he glanced around and then lowered his voice. She's been implying she wants to get the attention of the Order. Of course, I thought of you. With your help, with your connections, she might be willing to share her father's work with us.
She might not have anything, though, Jack said, frowning. She could be leading you on. It's in a female's nature to be manipulative and deceitful.
It could be that she's lying, Hart acknowledged. But she was the one who designed the effect you saw last night. It's quite extraordinary what she's able to do.
Designed it herself?
As much as it pains me to admit it, she won't tell me how she accomplished it. I think she's been teasing me, withholding that information to get what she wants.
Well, we can't let her get away with that, can we?
Jack said with a roguish grin. You have an idea?
Maybe with the right enticements I could soften her up, find out if she's being honest about what she has.
You'd do that for me? Hart said, pushing down an unexpected jolt of jealousy.
Of course. We're friends, aren't we, Darrigan?
Jack took another long drink.
Then it's not as though it would be a chore to breach her defenses.
Hart's hands clenched into fists beneath the table, but he kept his expression the picture of eager appreciation. I'd be awful grateful. I'd hate to be made a fool of, but if she does have her father's secrets, she could be very useful to me.
To both of us. Miss Felosic and her secrets don't stand a chance,
Jack said, raising his glass.
Not a chance at all.
Hart agreed pleasantly as he watched Jack finish off the last of the champagne. He couldn't have scripted the evening any better himself. Jack had fallen for the bait just as they'd planned for him to, but Hart couldn't shake the feeling that he'd made a misstep somehow. He just wasn't sure what it was or how it might come back to bite him later. Still, successes should be celebrated, so he pasted on his most charming smile and was about to call for another bottle when a shadow fell over his table. Hart looked up to find Paul Kelly standing over him.
Hello, Darrigan,
Kelly said genially. He was dressed impeccably, as usual, in a crisp suit, but his eyes held a warning.
Fancy meeting you here.
A moment of silence passed, where Hart was too shocked by Kelly's appearance to utter a word. It was as if he'd awoken to discover all those months of freedom had been nothing but a dream. He was 13 years old again, looking at his certain death.
"Aren't you going to introduce us?"
Kelly asked expectantly, shaking Hart from his stupor. Jack glanced at Kelly and then looked at Hart.
"Do you know this gentleman?"
he asked. And Hart could see the confusion in Jack's bleary gaze as he took in Kelly's well-cut clothes and his long-ago broken nose. He was stuck. Kelly was making enough of a name for himself that Jack might recognize it, and if he did, it might destroy all the work Hart had done to make himself seem respectable. But if he refused, Kelly was sure to make a scene.
"This is an old acquaintance of mine, Jack. Paul Kelly, Jack Grew. Jack, allow me to introduce you to Mr. Kelly."
Jack, who thankfully showed no sign of recognizing the name, shook Kelly's hand, and then, to Hart's horror, he asked Kelly to join them.
"We were just celebrating a mutually beneficial opportunity we stumbled upon," he told them.
"Were you?"
Kelly asked, taking the seat Esta had left open. He eyed the waiting glass of champagne.
"I'm a bit of a businessman myself," Kelly told him.
Jack sputtered a bit, making some excuses and trying not to reveal what they'd been talking about, as Paul Kelly sat on the other side of the table with his usual cold-eyed stare. Hart felt as though he couldn't breathe. He'd risked everything, including his mother's life, to keep Kelly away from Jack, and now they were sitting at a table together. He needed to get out of there, he thought, as he glanced again to the floor below, hoping for some sign of Esther's return.
"You have somewhere to be?"
Kelly said as he took a slim cigarette from a silver case.
"No,"
he lied.
"Nowhere at all."
Before Kelly could call him on his lie, a whistle sounded from the floor below. Hart turned in time to see a squad of helmeted policemen making their way into the ballroom, the beginning of a raid on the prostitutes that strolled the floor, and the illegal gambling that often took place in the back rooms.
"Well, gentlemen,"
said Kelly, who didn't seem the least bit surprised at the raid,
"I think it's time we make our exit."
The Missing Knife. Bridget's face was shadowed, but Esta could still make out the remains of a purplish bruise across the side of Bridget's cheek.
"I came for my knife," Esta said, realizing as the words tumbled from her mouth how absolutely stupid they sounded.
"What knife?" Bridget asked, looking both harried and confused at the same time.
"The one you took from my boot," Esta insisted. "I didn't take anything," Bridget said, glancing beyond Esta toward the entrance of the passageway. "You're mad if you think I did, and you're mad for coming back here after I went to the trouble to get you away."
"There was a knife," Esta said as ice settled into her veins. "There had to be, because if there was no knife, there might be no Dakari." But Bridget didn't seem to be lying.
"I'm not a thief, unlike some," Bridget snapped. "You need to get out of here. Do you have any idea what will happen to you if Corey sees you here?"
She took hold of Esta's wrist and tugged her toward the ballroom. But when she eased the panel open to enter the barroom again, the room on the other side had erupted into a riot. Women screamed, and men tumbled over each other to avoid the clubs that the police were using on the heads of anyone who struggled to get away.
"We have to go," Bridget said. "Come on. If they see us without escorts, they'll assume we're working girls. It's the whole point of the raid. They'll arrest us for sure."
But Esta had an escort. She looked up toward the balcony, but with the mess of people tearing at one another to get away, she couldn't tell if Hart was still there.
"Where are you going?"
Bridget shouted as Esta pulled away and began shoving her way through the crowd, pushing against the flow of people. She was so intent on searching for Hart that she didn't notice the policeman behind her until she heard the shrill scream of his whistle, and she didn't notice the baton he held until it came down on her head. The Water's Edge. The ballroom was in chaos. As soon as the whistle sounded, Hart felt paralyzed by the memories crashing into him. He was 11 again, cornered in the alley where he'd made his bed that night, unable to escape.
Darrigan!
Jack was pulling at him, saying something. But the sound of the whistles and shouts drowned out everything but the memory of being dragged from his sleep and into a black Maria packed so tightly with filthy men and women that he couldn't move. Couldn't get away from the stink of them, couldn't get away from their hands, grabbing at him, pulling at him. He couldn't breathe. Jack's voice came to him from somewhere far off.
This way, Darrigan.
Hart let himself be led, panicked, confusion keeping him from processing what was happening until they stepped out into an alley that reeked of rotten meat and piss, the smells of his childhood. It took everything he had not to retch. When the cool night air hit his face, he gasped, sucking the air into his lungs. He was barely aware of Jack shaking Paul Kelly's hand, thanking him for the help getting out of the hall.
Good seeing you again, Darrigan,
Kelly said with a rough slap on his back, before he hailed a cab and disappeared into the night. As he came back to himself, Hart had the sudden and delayed realization that he was no longer inside the Haymarket.
What are we doing out here, Jack?
We're not getting swept up in the raid, that's what,
Jack said. His hair was sticking up at an odd angle, and the shoulder of his jacket was torn, but he looked pleased with himself, almost exhilarated from their escape.
Damn nice of Kelly to help us out of that mess.
We can't leave without Esther, Hart said, starting to go back. Jack caught him by the arm.
Are you insane? The girl will be fine. All those jewels, they'll let her go. Hell, they'll probably escort her home. Come on, I can't be caught up in this, and I can't imagine you'd want to spend a night in the tombs either.
He'd pulled his arm away from Jack, but Hart didn't move. He couldn't be taken to the tombs, he thought, as the wave of panic crested over him again. Not again.
Are you coming or not?
Jack asked, tugging at him. Hart looked back at the rear door of the Haymarket.
But Esther, she'll be fine.
He turned on Jack.
You can't know that.
Jack gave him a shrug.
You're right, I can't. Think of it this way. If she gets caught up in the mess, at least she won't be keeping the Baron's journals from us anymore.
He elbowed Hart as he laughed at his own joke. Hart's fingers closed into a fist, and it took everything he had not to drive it into Jack's pretty white teeth. But to do that would destroy the con and any chance of ever getting the book.
Come on,
Jack insisted.
There's something I want to show you.
He couldn't leave Esther, but he also couldn't let Jack get away. Not when he was so damn close.
Well?
Jack asked, impatient. She was probably already outside, halfway back to their apartment. His apartment, he corrected.
She'd be fine, he told himself. If the tables were turned, she would probably do the same.
She'd improvise, wouldn't she? She was good at that.
Fine,
he told Jack, looking back at the door one last time.
Let's go.
They walked a block west, avoiding the noise coming from 6th Avenue, where some of the Haymarket's customers and waiter girls had tried to avoid the police, but ran right into them instead. If Esther had gone that way, if she went that way, she can get out of it. Whatever magic it was that allowed her to move like lightning, disappearing and reappearing in barely a blink, she'd be fine. He needed to stay with Jack. They were too close to let him off the hook now. The cab they found smelled like someone had been sick in it earlier, but Jack didn't give any indication that he noticed. Instead, he slouched back in his seat with his eyes half closed as the carriage started off. After a while, though, it became clear that Jack wasn't taking them toward the mansions on 5th Avenue, as Hart had expected. When he saw the spires of Trinity Church, a landmark well below the safety of Canal Street, he started to worry.
Where are we going?
Hart asked as the carriage rattled on. Jack opened his eyes enough to squint at him. You'll see, he said with a self-satisfied smile. Then he closed his eyes again and, a few seconds later, let out a soft snore. As they rode, Jack dozed drunkenly while Hart considered his options. But the carriage never stopped as it followed a route that cut deeper and deeper into the poorly lit neighborhood streets, each progressively darker and quieter than the last. When they approached the eastern edge of the island, Jack snorted and came awake with a jerk. When he saw where they were, he looked excited, anxious, and suddenly more sober than he had all night. But as they followed the shoreline, the closer they came to the towering span of the bridge, the more uneasy Hart became.
He couldn't cross that bridge, but he also couldn't stop the carriage without risking all the work he'd done to get Jack this comfortable. More important, Hart couldn't let Jack realize the real reason he couldn't cross that bridge.
Every block they passed brought the bridge closer still.
Hart glanced at Jack's wrist, noticing the sliver of exposed skin between his cuff and his gloves.
He'd wait until they turned toward the bridge just to be sure, until the danger of the brink was worth the risk. But then Jack rapped on the driver's window, and the carriage came to a shuddering stop.
We're here,
he said, excitement and anticipation shining in his eyes, despite the effects of the champagne. Hart took a breath, relieved that the carriage had finally stopped, but he didn't let his guard down. The docks that bordered the river in that part of town were a forest of ships' masts and a maze of warehouses crouched close to the ground. Hart wasn't familiar with the area. The river's edge was the domain of the longshoremen and the river rats who raided the cargo. Most people were smart enough to stay away from the docks, where the roughnecks often looked away if a body was dumped into the river. And most mages would have never chanced coming that close to the brink that silently circled the island somewhere just offshore. Even now, even with the water still some distance away, Hart could swear that he felt the chill of it. Jack gave the driver orders to wait, and then led them through the uneven grid of buildings bathed in moonlight, swinging his arms at his sides and whistling the occasional off-key tune, like they were walking through Central Park and not one of the dodgiest parts of the city. Hart never had trusted that sort of blind confidence. Usually it was a mask for ignorance, and in his experience, both were dangerous. Everywhere, shadows lurked, rustling in doorways and curling against the walls of buildings. Occasionally, one of the shadows would bring fire to its fingertips. A flicker of flame would come to life, the puff of smoke enwreathing a briefly illuminated face, and then the night would go dark again. It isn't magic, Hart reminded himself. Just a simple flare of a match. The mundane glow from the flickering tip of a cigarette. This close to the river, Hart could almost detect the scent of the water. On the other side lay everything he'd never been able to reach, an entire land that was more than the stinking streets and the day-after-day scrambling urgency of the city. A world where he could be something more than a rat in a trap. But in the next breath, the scent of water was covered by the heaviness of axle grease and soot, the ripeness of days-old fish and oyster shells. A reminder that he still had a long way to go before he could be making plans about a different future. Finally, they came to a long, unremarkable warehouse. Jack took a ring of keys from his coat and made quick work of the heavy padlocks on the wooden door. But before the last one clicked open, he turned to Hart.
You probably wouldn't even need a key, would you?
He asked, cocking his head to the side. Jack's face was covered by shadows, but his body had gone rigid, like he'd finally sobered up enough to comprehend what he was doing, to have second thoughts.
I'm not a thief, Jack. I know that, Jack shifted uneasily. But I'm taking a risk in showing you this. I think you'll understand, and I'm going to trust it'll interest you enough that I won't have to worry.
Whether I'm interested or not, you don't have to worry about me. I don't want any trouble. Jack frowned like he was puzzling over something. For a second, Hart thought Jack would change his mind, so he pulled on a look of boredom and moderate impatience.
Look, I didn't ask you to bring me here, but can we get on with it already? I need to get back and check on Esta, so if we're not going in...
No, Jack said, giving himself a visible shake.
You've come all this way, you should see it. I want you to.
He pushed the door inward. Beyond it, blank darkness waited, but Jack quickly lit a kerosene lamp near the door.
After you, he said.
In the center of the room, there was a large, misshapen object covered by a cloth. With a smile lighting his face as much as the lamp, Jack drew the heavy tarp off and revealed something that could have been pulled from the pages of Jules Verne. The machine clearly wasn't complete yet, but Hart could make out the gist of it. A large central globe made from what looked like glass, which was surrounded by three concentrically ringed arms that glinted in the light. It looked harmless enough, quiet and still as it was, but there was something about the machine that made Hart nervous.
Amazing, isn't it?
Jack said, giving one of the great orbiting arms a push, which made all the others glide slowly through their separate rotations as well.
What the hell is it?
Hart asked, trying to shake the sense of apprehension he had standing next to it.
This is the future, Darrigan, Jack said, beaming.
The future? Hart eyed him doubtfully.
Come here and take a look.
Jack walked past Hart to a long work table on the left side of the room. Various blueprints and maps were laid out in haphazard piles, anchored in place by drafting tools and angles. He motioned for Hart to join him. Reluctant to get too close to the strange machine, Hart made his way around the outer edge of the room to the table where Jack was standing. At the far end of it was a model, a small rectangular building with a single tower growing from its center. The tower was capped with an odd, onion-shaped roof that reminded Hart of a picture he'd seen once of a Russian church.
"What is all this?" Hart asked.
Jack pointed to the model of the building.
"My uncle's building a larger version of this out on Long Island. It's going to be a wireless transmitter. Tesla's doing the design. When it's done, it will transmit telegraphs, maybe even pictures, through the air. My uncle believes it's going to revolutionize the world of business."
"You don't think it will?" Hart asked, responding to the tone in Jack's words.
"I think he's thinking too small and missing the point entirely," Jack said as he began shuffling through a pile of papers. "Here, look."
Jack smoothed out one of the crumpled sheets for Hart to inspect.
"It's the philosopher's hand,"
he said, glancing up at Jack before returning his focus to the paper. The image was familiar to Hart. He'd studied enough alchemy to recognize the symbol and knew what it stood for.
"Exactly. I knew you'd understand," Jack said, excitement lighting his eyes. "Five fingers for five distinct elements, the basis of all we know and understand about otherworldly power. Everyone who studies the occult arts knows that the elements are the key to unlocking the secrets of magic. If you isolate the individual elements, you can harness their energy and command them to bend your will. But look what holds them together."
The image depicted a hand with its fingers spread wide, each tipped with a different symbol. A key, a crown, a lantern, a star, and the moon. In the open palm, the fish and the flame, the symbols for
Mercury,
Hart said, tapping the center of the palm.
"The element that transcends all others, sometimes known as quicksilver."
"Or ether," Jack added.
"The same substance the Baron was able to isolate, if you're right."
"What's your point, Jack?" Hart asked, unease crawling down his spine. Perhaps he'd played his game a little too well. Jack had not only taken the hook, he now seemed to be dragging him out to sea.
"And what does this have to do with that machine? Or with the future?"
"Everything." Jack stopped short.
"It has everything to do with the future. Every day the world sends more and more of its filth to our shores. Among them, mages sneak into our city. Filthy, uncivilized, dangerous. Their very existence threatens our civilization, and as we've seen for ourselves, the safety of our property and our citizens. But this machine will change everything, Darrigan. He ran his finger over the tip of the tower's roofline. It will put a stop to that threat once and for all. The Brink already keeps the mages in their place.
Maybe that was true during a simpler time, Jack said.
When the Brink was created, there were far fewer coming here. It was enough to simply trap them on an island, but the numbers have been steadily increasing. There have been attempts to meet the growing threat, of course. Ellis Island, for instance, was supposed to keep mages from ever setting foot on our shores, but those measures haven't been enough. Devious as they are, more maggots slip through the inspectors every day. There are even reports that some have made it off the island and onto the mainland. That cannot stand. The Order knows something has to be done. They've been working on a plan to increase the Brink's reach, but what they're doing won't work.
No? Hart kept his eyes trained on the model of the building, feigning interest to cover his fear.
Not as long as they're using old-fashioned ideas, old-fashioned magic, instead of modern science. And so long as they're thinking too small.
The Brink is small?
Hart asked, trying to keep his voice even.
Gru nodded.
But my machine won't be. Consider this, Darrigan. Tesla's tower will revolutionize wireless transmission.
True.
But it's only the beginning of what could be done with it. With the kind of power this receiver can generate, it could make the Brink obsolete.
He smoothed out the rumpled paper bearing the philosopher's hand again.
The Brink was created more than a century ago by a ritual manipulation of the elements through the ether. It's old-fashioned alchemy. 5 artifacts, each imbued with the power of one of the basic elements, were used to complete the ritual. Like this hand, all the elements are connected through the ether, the palm. It creates a circuit of sorts. When a magus passes through it, their power unbalances that circuit, and whatever magic they possess is drawn toward the elemental energies of the Brink as it attempts to balance itself. The whole system is self-perpetuating, powered by the very feral magic it takes, which is why it's lasted for so long with very little maintenance. But the ether is key, Jack said eagerly. There are 2 problems with the Brink, though. First, the power taken from any magus who tries to cross the Brink becomes part of the circuit, but we can't do anything more with that power. For all intents and purposes, it's lost. We can't use it.
Jack eyed him.
That's a waste, don't you think?
Yes, Hart forced out, his stomach turning. Quite.
This machine would put an end to that. Instead of redistributing the power it harvests, it collects it and holds it separately.
And the other problem?
The Brink is limited by its size. When it was first created, no one knew how quickly the city would grow or that the wilds of Brooklyn and beyond would become what they have. No one could have imagined how many people would come to our shores. No one imagined that they would come despite the Brink.
Desperate people will do desperate things, Hart murmured.
They would chance the Brink and commit themselves to living in a rat trap of a city because it was still better than the places they came from, places still ravaged by the hate spurred on during the disenchantment, because the hope for a different future was that powerful.
It's not desperation, Darrigan. It's a complete disregard for our way of life. The Order is aware of this problem, of course.
They were hoping to unveil their grand plan at the upcoming conclave when the entire Order gathers, but it isn't working. The original artifacts aren't powerful enough to expand the size of the Brink without making it unstable. Now they're trying to replicate the original creation of the Brink, all in the hope that perhaps they might be able to recreate it in other places, trap any mages that manage to avoid New York. That hasn't worked either.
He shook his head, a mocking expression on his face.
But will the inner circle listen to me?
No,
Hart asked, trying to hide his hopefulness.
Of course not. They're stuck in the past, and its weight is dragging them under. It will drag us all under.
With a violent motion, Jack swept the papers off the table, causing them to flutter into the air and then settle onto the ground at Hart's feet.
They're so focused on containing the maggots, they don't realize it has never worked.
They're like rats, the way their numbers seem to be growing. Like rats, they need to be exterminated, and when I get my machine working, that's exactly what we'll do. He walked over to it and ran his hands over the shining metal of one of the orbital arms. Once this machine is installed in Tesla's single tower, it will have enough energy to clean a 100-mile radius of any feral magic. Much more efficient than the old rituals. Imagine one of these in every major city. It would send a message, a warning, to any who would come to this country and try to turn us from our destiny.
100 miles? Hart asked, feeling almost faint. You're sure?
The last time we tested it, the field it generated reached as far as Fulton Street, and that was only at a fraction of its capacity. Jack smiled slyly.
Quite impressive, Hart said, but he thought of Tilly as he said it and felt sick. He hadn't realized what Jack was capable of. He'd been goading him on, encouraging him, when he should have been paying more attention.
It is, isn't it?
Jack agreed.
When I multiply what this machine is capable of by the power of Tesla's transmitter, we can easily wipe out all the feral magic in Manhattan. Maybe even reach as far as Philadelphia and Boston.
But unlike the Brink, the power this machine will generate once it's installed in Tesla's tower would be usable. Imagine it. Feral magic eradicated, transformed into civilized power that could be used to guide and shape the future of this new century. Or it could become a weapon unlike any the world has ever seen. This country could become even greater than the empires of Europe after the disenchantment.
Hart didn't have any idea how to respond without giving away his true feelings. He hadn't realized that the Brink kept the power it took from Magus, but to increase that danger? If Jack succeeded, if the Order ever controlled such a machine, magic would be doomed everywhere, as would every single person with an affinity. If Jack was right about the machine's possibilities, Hart's plan to leave the city was pointless. If he didn't find a way to stop Jack, to destroy the machine, there wouldn't be anywhere to hide.
You said the machine doesn't work? He asked.
No.
Jack scraped his hand through his hair, frustrated.
Not yet, at least. I haven't found a way to stabilize the power that it collects. There's something about feral magic that isn't stable. The last one I built didn't last a week before it blew up and killed my machinist.
His eyes were a little wild as they searched the silent metal, as though it would whisper its secrets if he waited long enough.
All the power it generated was lost.
Just like Tilly. The existence of the machine explained the strange boundary on Fulton Street, but if Tilly had died when the machine exploded, what did that mean about Dolph's plan to destroy the Brink?
It's not the machine, Jack continued, not noticing Hart's dismay. The design is flawless. I did it myself. The mechanism works perfectly when it's in motion. But after meeting your Miss Filosic, I've realized what I'm missing.
You have? Hart asked, not liking the sound of that one bit.
It's the ether I've been forgetting about.
The ether?
He could barely make himself say the word.
Yes, of course. I don't know why it didn't occur to me before.
Jack ran a trembling hand through his hair again, making himself look even more disheveled and unhinged.
Without isolating the ether, the power would be unstable, unpredictable. In the philosopher's hand, ether is what stabilizes the elements, so it might also stabilize the power this machine harvests. The problem is, no one since the last magician has been able to isolate or produce it.
The last magician? Hart's head was still spinning.
I'm afraid I'm not sure who that is.
No?
Jack's brows wrinkled in surprise, and an unwelcome wariness flashed in his eyes.
At least not by that particular name, Hart amended.
It felt as though everything were spinning out of control. Jack studied him a moment longer.
The last magician was someone like us, devoted to studying the Hermetic arts many centuries ago.
It's rumored that he succeeded in ways others haven't since. Some of his breakthroughs helped to create the Brink. He was a member of the Order? Not exactly, but the Order built upon his work. We have his journal, a record of all he'd learned and all he accomplished, a tome called the Ars Arcana. Arcanum, of course, being another name for the Philosopher's Stone. That can't be a coincidence, Hart said, knowing that Jack could never, never get the book. You think this book will help you isolate Aether? I do, but the Order keeps it under lock and key. Only the highest-ranking members have access to it. I've been trying to take a look for months now, but I'm not a member of the Inner Circle. Now, that no longer matters. Jack smiled, an unholy excitement lighting his face. If you're right about your Miss Filosic, I might not need to see those records. Not if we can get her to share her father's secrets with us. Hart's mind raced to stay ahead of Jack. The machine changed everything. Hart suddenly remembered the old man's prediction that he would somehow destroy the book. He hadn't completely believed Esta, hadn't believed in the prediction. But now he understood because he could see clearly what he had to do. He needed the book now more than ever. You'd have to get her to trust you, Hart said as an idea struck him. If Jack was interested in Esta, if he was still on the hook, they could still run their game. If they could hold off Jack and get the book, maybe he could still get out of the city. As soon as he was out, he would destroy the book and any chance Jack or the Order had of finishing this machine. He wouldn't be able to tell Esta until it was over. She didn't understand what was at stake. If not now with Jack, then someday with someone. And he knew that with her faith in the old man's words, he would never convince her that the book was too dangerous to exist. But that didn't mean she couldn't still help him. When everything was done, when they were safe, maybe he'd be able to explain. Maybe she'd even forgive him. And if she didn't, he'd lived with worse. I'm sure that won't be a problem, Jack said with a devilish smile. It's possible my machine could be working before the conclave as I planned. The Order won't have any choice but to recognize your genius, Hart told him, hiding his true feelings behind his most dazzling smile. Inside, he felt like he could barely breathe. And the maggots won't have a chance. Hart nodded his agreement and clapped Jack on the back. But silently he vowed to do everything in his power to make sure that future never came to be. A change of heart. It was nearly 3 in the morning before Hart finally got rid of Jack and made his way back home. He let himself into the apartment, expecting to find Esta already locked in his room. Or, more likely, wide-eyed and ready to throttle him for leaving her. After what Jack had shown him, though, he'd be happy to take his chances with her anger. He couldn't get away from the docks and from that nightmare of a machine fast enough. But when he lit the lamps, there was no sign she'd even been there. He told himself he'd wait an hour and force himself to sit, watching the clock on the side table as the seconds ticked by. By the time 37 minutes had passed, he'd had enough. Grabbing his coat and hat, he headed out again to find her. The streets had been long since cleared by the time he made it back to the Haymarket. Police barriers were up, and the front door of the dance hall had been boarded over. The smell of smoke still hung in the air. The sidewalks were mostly empty, but a boy was asleep in one of the doorways nearby, curled against the street. Hart tapped him gently to wake him. When the boy's eyes blinked open, angry at the disruption, Hart held up a dollar and watched the boy's eyes go wide. Did you see a woman in a gold-colored gown tonight? I've seen lots of women, the boy said, straightening his soft cap and reaching for the money. Hart pulled it away. She was wearing a necklace with garnets and diamonds that looked like a collar, and black feathers in her hair. I might have seen her, the boy said, eyeing him. Where? I think she was with everyone else they took off to the tombs.
The boy pulled the money from Hart's grip.
But they all looked the same, so maybe it wasn't her.
He tucked the money into his shirt and turned back over. The tombs. A memory of a damp floor and a crowded room filled with rough